Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Pennsylvania's primary election is coming up fast, May 18th. WHYY's political reporter Katie Meyer will join us with a comprehensive look and how home gardeners can help declining bee populations recover. We'll talk about a new study at the Mount Cuba Center in Delaware. But first, as COVID restrictions ease and the country begins to inch its way back to the old normal, difficult questions about fallout from the pandemic are emerging. One involves the threat of eviction for countless families hammered by job loss and illness. A CDC nationwide ban on eviction will remain in effect at least until Wednesday. But when the moratorium is eventually lifted and eviction orders resume, tenants will be required to navigate a complex and often confusing legal process, and many are not adequately equipped to do so. In Delaware, few renters have access to legal counsel. In fact, an analysis by the University of Delaware puts the share of tenants with representation at just 2%, while the vast majority of landlords are accompanied by representation at eviction hearings. WHYY's Mark Eichmann is Deputy Managing Director of the Delaware Desk, and he joins us now with more. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mary.
Let's first get to a quick update on the evictions process in Delaware, as it pertains to the pandemic. A state moratorium was in place until July of last year, and at that point, it was modified. How so, Mark?
The governor changed his executive order to allow eviction proceedings that were defined as necessary in the interest of justice, to give those landlords a little bit more leeway in getting some of their rental money back from renters who were well past due in the interest of justice as defined by the courts. So as that happened, evictions started to increase, but the courts were also working on implementing a dispute resolution process in hopes of still helping some of those tenants who were going through this now necessary in interest of justice evictions work out some of their differences with the landlords, hopefully outside of the eviction process. That's helped some, but not all, as some evictions and those proceedings have continued to go forward over the past almost a year now.
And so when we compare the number of proceedings, eviction proceedings that are happening now, as to say a normal quote unquote year, a non-pandemic year, where do we stand? What percentage?
Right. So we're tracking back up almost about half of what a regular year would see for evictions. That's according to analysis done by the Eviction Lab project at Princeton, which kind of tracks these numbers even here in Delaware. So over the past 10 months since last July, evictions have trended to return to about 43% of what a normal year would look like. Some months more than half of the normal rate in a non-pandemic year, others less. But on average, it's about 43% of what we would see, say, in 2019 before the pandemic started and evictions kind of went on hold.
Okay. And breaking it down even a bit further, approximately how many people or families are evicted on a daily basis in Delaware?
It's about 14 tenants evicted in the state on an average day, according to a study by the University of Delaware. That translates to about 5% of all renters in the state over the course of a year, and that's actually higher than the national average by about 2 percentage points. So it's especially a problem here in Delaware, and it's something that I think has been a problem. It's been high before the pandemic started, and really this, as you said in the introduction, has really been exacerbated and kind of highlighted the plight that a lot of these renters are going through and the difficulty that they have has just gotten worse because so many are out of work and struggling to make ends meet over the past year as a lot of folks have had difficulty during the pandemic.
Yeah. A landlord will often begin eviction proceedings when a tenant is behind on rent. What sorts of dollar amounts are we generally talking about here? And is there a minimum in Delaware before a landlord can move to evict?
This is something that really kind of surprised me when I was working on this story. In Delaware, there is no minimum amount owed to a landlord for them to file and to start the eviction process. So the University of Delaware looked into this and examined 300 evictions before the pandemic started. And out of those 300, 155 cases resulted in the landlord winning back rent and other expenses from the tenant. They won in the hearing, the landlord did. Mm-hmm. And of those cases, 28% were given awards less than $1,000, and 11% were less than just $300. And in a couple of cases, six cases, the back rent that was owed was less than $50. So that's a big concern for folks advocating now for better treatment for renters in the state. That's one of their big hooks that they're pushing.
So when tenants do find themselves in an eviction hearing, they are there quite often by themselves. Not the case for landlords. Tell us more about this, Mark.
Yeah, tenants overwhelmingly outmatched by landlords when it comes to legal representation at these proceedings. You know, you can kind of picture it as a defendant in a court case representing themselves. The outcome is rarely going to be in favor of the person who's representing themselves versus, say, a high-powered attorney. And it's the same thing for landlords versus tenants. According to this study by the University of Delaware's Biden School of Public Policy and Administration, landlords have legal help at their side at 86% of eviction hearings. Tenants, on the other hand, have just 2% of cases, they have legal counsel helping them through the process. And so just like the defendant who's representing themselves, the tenant kind of on their own, it's really turned into sort of a David versus Goliath. At least in knowledge of the proceedings, you know, having an attorney by your side for a landlord is really going to be to your advantage over a tenant kind of representing themselves. And so that's translated into much higher rates of success, obviously, for landlords versus tenants kind of winning these eviction hearings.
Well, State Representative Brian Townsend, a Democrat, has stepped in and is co-sponsoring legislation which would attempt to level the playing field by creating a right to counsel. Who would be eligible for legal representation under this legislation? Who exactly?
Yeah, under the bill, anybody who has a household income of 200% or less of the federal poverty line would get this guaranteed right to a counsel. They'd get state-funded legal help provided by a nonprofit to help navigate the process. So if we're comparing it to a court case, this is sort of like your public defender or a court-appointed attorney, somebody who would help you go through the process. So as long as you're making less than 200% of the federal poverty line, you'd get that under this bill. So, for instance, if you have a household of four and you're making less than $53,000 a year, you'd be eligible for this right. And it's something that Senator Townsend says in cities where it's been put into place elsewhere in the country, it's really helped tenants turn the tide and win or settle their eviction proceedings in their favor in more than half the cases. So just having an attorney by their side, you know, really makes a difference.
Yeah, huge difference.
In being the David versus the Goliath of a landlord with a lawyer.
And Mark, would this legislation tighten the parameters for eviction, you know, say when rent is the issue?
Right. It would also create this kind of the floor for an eviction proceeding to start, a monetary floor. Like you'd have to, a landlord could not start an eviction process under this bill unless the tenant owes at least $500 or a full month's rent. So it wouldn't be, you couldn't take somebody to an eviction hearing and start that process for, you know, $50 or $100, as is the case currently. So it really raises the bar for gives renters a little bit of a more of a breathing room than it currently exists.
What's your sense as to whether this bill will gain traction in the legislature? Do you expect a significant opposition from landlords?
I think that's fair to say. There definitely will be, I imagine, landlord groups forming some coordinated opposition to this. There's also some concerns in legislative hall about funding for this bill, because the state would be putting up the money to pay for the legal counsel for the renters. And, you know, as that number grows, as the number of eviction cases grow, that number will become a bigger price tag. So I think there's concerns there in Dover. But if Townsend can rally his fellow Democrats who hold a significant advantage in Dover in numbers, it's possible this could get done before the end of the legislative session, which happens on June 30th, kind of just a wait to see. But I expect some pretty heavy opposition from the landlords groups.
Okay. Any immediate movement for this bill? What happens next?
Yeah, it's up this week. So Townsend chairs the Senate Housing Committee, and it's been assigned to his committee. So he'll host a hearing on the bill Wednesday, which we should get our first real look at opposition to it during that hearing on Wednesday.
Okay. Well, turning our attention to some other news of the pandemic, the vaccine waiting list in Delaware is now a thing of the past, Mark. Why do health officials believe the waiting list is no longer needed?
Well, it's sort of a victim of its own success, I guess. The list was created at the beginning of the year to make sure residents at the highest risk, especially those over the age of 65, were the first in line to get it, and they could be distributed as quickly as possible. The list has gradually expanded to include younger and younger Delawareans, and now everybody over the age of 16 was eligible to get on there. But after more than 150,000 residents got their shots through the waiting list, the state's kind of finding it difficult over the past several weeks to get people who are still left on the list signed up for the vaccine, signed up for appointments. And the Division of Public Health really feels that everybody who's kind of left on this list now has already gotten the vaccine some other way. There's no real, clearinghouse for all these people to have their names, for the state to know exactly who's gotten the vaccine through the list. But because there are so few signing up for appointments, they think that everybody on the list who wants a vaccine has gotten one through some other way. So now the state has kind of pivoted, and instead of the waiting list, they're using their efforts to point people to pharmacies and public health clinics and other spots where the vaccine is readily available. Folks can just walk up, even in some places without appointments, and get their shots.
And briefly, speaking of younger Delawareans, students returning to the University of Delaware campus in the fall will need to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but faculty and staff are not being required to get the vaccine at UD. What's the reasoning?
Right. School officials kind of saying that the elevated risk is really to the students living together on campus in really close arrangements. Plus, the social behaviors of college students tend to be a lot closer to each other than say faculty or staff, and so that's kind of their reasoning. The school also requires students to be immunized against things like measles and mumps, but that's not the case for most campus workers. So, a little bit different population. There could before the school year starts that could change. But we'll wait and see.
Okay. And worth noting also, Delaware State University students also must be vaccinated if they are returning to campus in the fall. Mark Eichmann, Deputy Managing Director, or I should say editor of WHYY's Delaware Desk. As always, a pleasure.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Talk to you soon. Stay with us on the Regional Roundup. WHYY's political reporter Katie Meyer will be with us to talk about a preview of the upcoming primary elections in Pennsylvania, May 18th. Important information. Hope you join us. Stay tuned. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Pennsylvanians head to the polls in just over a week. Primary election day is Tuesday, May 18th. And while this year's primary hasn't garnered the fevered attention of the elections of 2020, there are issues and contests of note on the ballot, including the race for district attorney in Philadelphia and a pair of ballot questions, which, if approved, would hand considerable control of disaster declarations from the governor to the legislature. Also, mail-in balloting remains in place, but there are deadlines coming up for those choosing to go this route. We'll have details on all of this and more with WHYY's political reporter Katie Meyer, who is joining us right now on the Roundup. Hello, Katie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Okay, progressive Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner, big race this year. His opponent in the Democratic race for district attorney in the primary is former homicide prosecutor Carlos Vega. Katie, observers are saying a primary win is not necessarily a sure thing for the incumbent Krasner. What are some of the factors at play here?
So, I mean, one of the big one is that 2020 has been a really destabilizing year in a lot of ways. People have been out of work and, you know, due to a variety of factors, the homicide rate in Philadelphia has soared. Almost 500 people last year were shot in Philly, but that was 40% more than in 2019. The only higher year was 1990. And so now, obviously, you know, because of that increase, we know gun crimes were not so high for all of Krasner's tenure. He's been there almost 4 years, but convictions for gun crimes were down. Critics have been really hanging on to this, saying that there is a lack of aggressiveness in the office, blaming Krasner for the spike in crime. So that's one of the big factors here. You know, you have this progressive DA who came in with the very clear stated agenda of saying we're going to cut down on mass incarceration in Philadelphia, wants to end mass incarceration and come in as a reformer and deal with these crimes very differently. And then you also had very, you know, firm backlash. And that is what you're seeing in this Democratic primary.
Tell us a bit about Carlos Vega, whom Krasner fired 3 years ago when he first took office.
Yeah, so Vega was in the DA's office for a long time. He joined in the 80s. He worked his way up. According to his campaign, he was the first Latino homicide prosecutor. And yeah, he was one of the first prosecutors Krasner fired when he took over in 2018. You know, Vega actually ended up suing the DA's office for age discrimination. And, you know, when he's pitching himself as an alternative to Krasner, he's basically kind of saying, I'm a sensible alternative. He's saying, I am not going to be the big reformer that Krasner will. He does have some of the same platforms. He said, you know, yes, we should hold bad cops accountable. We should, you know, cut down on cash bail use. But, you know, I think they have very different views, for instance, on the death penalty. You know, Vega has said he would seek it. Krasner has not in his time as DA. So big differences.
And Charles Peruto Jr. is the only Republican in the GOP race for Philadelphia DA. So he advances to the general election. He's been around a long time, Katie, and has some name recognition. Does he stand a chance? I mean, looking all the way ahead to November, you know, Philly's primarily a Democratic town. Is there a chance Peruto might make some headway here?
Well, so Peruto, should be said, he has said he's going to drop out if Vega wins the primary. So he's really only, you know, if Krasner wins this primary, he's going to stay in. And he would be a long shot, you know, either way. Yeah, I mean, he was a Democrat until relatively recently. He said he's kind of been outraged at how Krasner's handled the office. But the thing that he is most well known for, I mean, this was several years ago. A young woman was found dead in his bathtub when he was out of town. They had been dating. Yeah. A grand jury was convened to investigate the death. He was cleared of any wrongdoing, but it was a dramatic thing that happened. It was made into a Lifetime movie. So that is kind of the thing that people know him for, rather than like a long, you know, legal record in Philadelphia.
Worth mentioning, too, the other citywide race in Philly is for controller, and incumbent Rebecca Reinhart has an easy time of it. No challengers. So,
no challengers, yeah. And people have kind of looked forward and said, you know, she did actually raise a bunch of money. You know, is she interested in running for mayor in 2023? She said, you know, I am focused on my current job right now. But, yeah, I mean, she's certainly been a high-profile figure during her time as controller.
And we'll keep an eye on that one. All right, so as we discussed a month ago on the regional roundup, there are a fair number of partisan judicial races in the upcoming Pennsylvania primary, including those for open seats on the state Supreme Court, Superior Court, and Commonwealth Court. Quick refresher, Katie, how many seats are we talking about for each court?
Yes. So on the Supreme Court, one open seat. There's three Republicans and a Democrat running for that. On the Superior Court, also one seat. It's flipped, three Democrats and a Republican running for that one. And then there's two open seats on the Commonwealth Court. There's two Republicans and four Democrats running. One of the Republicans is Drew Crompton. He was actually appointed. He's currently on the court. He was appointed to fill a vacancy. And so now he has to run to get a full 10-year term. So, vacancies all down the top appellate courts in Pennsylvania.
And there are also elections for openings on common pleas courts across the Philadelphia, the so-called collar counties. As you report, these courts often serve as the very first step for any significant legal issue. Which types of issues are heard in the Court of Common Pleas?
So, I mean, it's a lot of stuff, but, you know, often it'll be family issues, divorce, child custody, if you have to distribute it, an estate, abuse charges. So that as well as a lot of other civil and criminal issues. They also take appeals from the magisterial courts and from Philly and Pittsburgh's municipal courts. And those will hear issues like landlord-tenant disputes, things like that. So, you know, it's a huge range of cases that these courts can handle.
And interestingly, some of these candidates for open seats on courts of common pleas are cross-filed. Explain cross-filing.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. Basically, just, you know, we have a closed primary system in Pennsylvania, which means that you have to be registered for a party to vote in that party's primary. Mm-hmm. But what candidates can do if they want to is just run in both primaries. It doesn't matter how they personally are registered as a voter. So in the common pleas races, for instance, you see a lot of candidates doing this. Even no matter if they're a Republican or a Democrat, they're running in both primaries.
Interesting. Didn't realize they could do that.
Oh, yeah.
So there are numerous candidates running for open spots on common pleas courts in Bucks, Montgomery, Delaware, and Chester County. So I'm going to recommend that listeners check out the article you helped to report. It is called A Voter's Guide to 2021 Court Elections in Bucks, Monco, Delco, and Chester Counties. And just head to whyy.org to find the article. Lots of terrific information there. One more question, you know, on judicial races, Katie. You know, they typically don't garner a lot of attention, but as we discussed recently, you know, the courts play a powerful role in shaping policy. Just remind us of what that role is or can be.
And this we especially see in like the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania, where again there is an open seat, high profile election, but the courts can make a huge difference in how politics works. And the big case that we saw a couple of years ago was that the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania threw out the congressional map. They ruled that it was unconstitutional and it was gerrymandered, clearly to favor Republicans. And so they ordered the legislature to redraw it, to draw a new map. Then the legislature couldn't decide on one in the time span that the court, you know, provided. And so the court hired somebody basically to draw the map. And that became the new congressional map. And it radically changed the electoral landscape in Pennsylvania's congressional delegation. Before, Republicans had a very clear majority. It changed that there. And you know, we're losing a seat now, but it was 9-9, yeah. Republicans, 9 Democrats for a few years. So huge implications there. And I should say, you know, decisions like that, they also don't happen in a vacuum. You know, there were repercussions for that. A lot of Republicans saw that as the court overreaching. And now they're, you know, working on this initiative. And, you know, we will see where it goes. But they want to make the court basically elected not just by party, but by region, too. So judges would have to come from very specific regions of the state. They say that's to make it so that it's not so many judges from Philly and Pittsburgh. Right. I should say, I mean, this is a backlash against the Democrats on the court, but the Democrats have only held the court since 2015. So it's not like Democrats have had a stranglehold on this court for a long time.
But some pretty big decisions since 2015 on the state Supreme Court.
Some very big decisions, yes. We should also note some controversial decisions about the election, too. You know, extending, for instance, the time for them to accept ballots until 3 days after the 2020 election. Just, you know, big decisions like that.
Yeah. So the GOP majority in Harrisburg is ready for change. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, there are a number of ballot questions to consider on the statewide ballot. Question number one asks whether the state constitution should be changed to allow a simple majority in the legislature to extend or end a disaster declaration without input from the governor. Right now, extending or ending a disaster declaration is the governor's responsibility. And again, politics here, Katie, a legislative reaction to Governor Wolf's decisions regarding the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we saw at the beginning of this pandemic, Governor Wolf called a disaster emergency declaration. You have to renew those every 90 days, and he has continued renewing it. It's still going. Republicans say that's too much power for the governor to have unilaterally. So there actually is some disagreement about how the amendment would actually affect Wolf's powers. Republicans say it would keep him, for instance, from enforcing measures like business restrictions, social distancing. So we would have to see. I mean, that would probably actually be worked out in the courts after the, if this does pass. But yeah, I mean, so disaster declarations traditionally, you know, they're used for things like snowstorms, hurricanes, just like natural disasters often. Wolf kind of innovated a little bit. He's been using them for the opioid emergency, but or just, you know, basically had an ongoing one for a long time, saying that, you know, opioid deaths are too high in Pennsylvania. This gives us some additional options to deal with those things. Republicans didn't really care about that, but this has been a very, very controversial issue. And so they're saying now, yeah, we want to be able to end these declarations as sort of a check on Wolf's power. Now, Wolf supporters of the current way that the system works have said, you know, that just kind of goes against the way these are supposed to work. It's going to take away the nimbleness with which we can respond to natural disasters. You know, it's much more difficult to convene the entire very, very large Pennsylvania legislature to end a declaration or extend a declaration than it is for the governor to do it unilaterally.
And again, the question number two seeks approval to end a disaster declaration after 21 days as opposed to 90. An extension would need legislative approval. So those two ballot questions kind of walk hand in hand.
Hand in hand, you're right. And also, I mean, again, this just, we, you know, 90 to 21 days for a disaster declaration, it is a difference. And so, you know, we would have to, if there was like a long-term disaster, like for instance, the pandemic, it just has to be renewed that much more often.
Ballot question number three, statewide ballot question in Pennsylvania asks whether the Constitution should be amended to enshrine a equality of rights under the law, regardless of a person's race or ethnicity. From your perspective, Katie Meyer, did this grow out of the social justice movement following the murder of George Floyd?
It did, yeah. Senator Vince Hughes, a high-ranking Democrat, he was the one who, just during the debate on, you know, electoral and legislative responses to Floyd's death, this ended up getting put into the package that was being considered. And it has not been controversial. Republicans have been on board. And it's actually, I mean, so Pennsylvania law, it already does provide protections against housing, education, public accommodation, discrimination based on race and ethnicity. So this would just kind of add an additional layer of just enshrinement in, you know, the very, very like core of Pennsylvania law.
Okay. And finally, as far as the ballot questions are concerned, a question four, statewide question rather, asks whether municipal fire and emergency services companies should have the ability to apply for loans through a state program for volunteer fire companies. Mm-hmm. And fifth ballot question, Philly vote for Philly voters anyway, will ask whether the Home Rule Charter should be amended to expand the Board of License and Inspection Review. The Board of License and Inspection Review oversees appeals regarding licenses to carry firearms and violations issued by the Department of Licenses and Inspection. So I think we've pretty much covered the ballot questions.
Yes, those are the ballot questions. Those last two aren't super controversial.
Yeah. So, all right. So to the nuts and bolts of the voting process, will the primary election next week look much different than the 2020 general election? I mean, a sizable number of people are now vaccinated. Katie, do we expect more polling places to be open than they were in November?
I mean, so yeah, in November, there were issues about polling places. One of the big ones was just like not having enough people to work them. You know, the actual numbers, I don't exactly know what we're going to see, but I think it's not a super, you know, an issue of high concern right now, just because turnout for elections in quote unquote off years, so years when a presidential election is not at the top of the ballot, it tends to be much lower. We tend to see it somewhere in the 20-30% range. So we will see. I mean, hopefully lots and lots of people turn out to vote this election, but we're not expecting the kind of lines that were like of concern during the 2020 election. And this is just like by way of comparison, but we saw like a roughly 70% turnout for that election. Yeah. So huge difference. That was a huge election. So polling places aren't expected to be a big problem. People are still voting by mail. Lots of people are voting by mail.
Yep.
And you can still send in your mail ballot. You can no longer apply for one, but you know, no worries. Just send, actually, sorry, you can't register to vote anymore. You can get a mail ballot. You can turn it in. You have lots of options still to vote.
So when is the latest a person can get a mail-in ballot, bearing in mind that the election is in just over a week?
Yeah. So let me look up the date. Do you have the date? So yes, here it is. So applications for a mail-in or absentee ballot, they had to be received by May 11th. That's tomorrow.
Yep.
So, you know, you still have a day to do that. Do it if you would like to. If you haven't gotten a mail ballot or you don't think you have time, you can still go and vote in person. If you got a mail ballot and you haven't filled it out, you can always, you know, if you can't find a place to turn it in, I believe you can still turn in. You can always turn in your mail ballot at the county election office.
Okay.
But you can also vote provisionally at your regular polling place if that is something you would prefer to do.
Okay. And I'm not sure if you have the answer to this question at your fingertips, but does a ballot, I mean, will a postmark of May 18th suffice if you're mailing, or does it just physically have to be at the elections office by May 18th, or does it count?
A postmark will not be sufficient.
Okay.
It has to be physically at your county election office by May 18th at 8 p.m.
Okay. And again, there are options. If you decide you're not going to mail that ballot in because it's too late, there are options.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
you absolutely. Drop boxes
options.
And the county office and everything. And also,
yep.
we should make a note here of a naked ballot warning. I mean, there, you know, the actual structure of the ballot is going to be the same as it was back in the general election. There's a secrecy envelope included in the package, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. And you have to have that secrecy envelope included. If you forget it, it could call your, you know, the provenance of your ballot into question, and it might not be counted. So make sure you put that extra little envelope inside the ballot when you send it back.
Okay. And as far as mail-in balloting is concerned, Katie, back in October of 2019, the General Assembly, led by Republicans in Pennsylvania, passed Act 77, which allows this. Is it being challenged in Pennsylvania? Do you know? We've got about 30 seconds left.
Sure. I mean, so there haven't been any changes made, but yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about how to change the voting process in Pennsylvania. A lot of it is politically motivated. There have been efforts to do things like voter ID laws. Nothing has happened so far, but we're keeping an eye on it.
All right. Katie Meyer is WHYY's political reporter. Thanks so much for the primer. And yeah, I think we're ready for the election next week. May 18th,
so.
Pennsylvania's
yes,
primary election.
May 18th. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Just ahead on the regional roundup, we're going to be talking about a new survey regarding the declining bee population and the pollinating plants that can help to restore that population. We'll be speaking with Eileen Boyle of the Mount Cuba Center Botanical Garden in Delaware. Stay with us. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The precipitous decline of the bee population in America and across the world has been well documented. Scientists point to insecticide poisoning, climate change, habitat loss, and disease as major factors. Bees, of course, are critical to human health and even survival. Much of the food we eat is dependent on the pollination of fruit and vegetable crops. But even as it seems the odds might be stacked against this hardworking insect, there's encouraging news in a new study of bees done at the Mount Cuba Center in Hockessin, Delaware. Mount Cuba is a public garden featuring both wild and cultivated areas, and the research found a greater diversity of bees in the planned gardens. So here's a question. Can home gardeners make a difference in helping bee populations recover by cultivating native plants? The study suggests the answer is yes. Here to discuss the research with us is Eileen Boyle, Director of Conservation and Research at the Mount Cuba Center, and she is with us for the rest of the hour. Hello, Eileen. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Most of us, when we think about bees, probably, you know, think about the bumblebee or a honeybee, but apparently there are at least 3,600 species of bees native to North America, and we don't know much about some of these species. Tell us about, you know, what you've observed at the Mount Cuba Center and how the idea for this study came about.
Yeah, what happened was Mount Cuba Center is a wonderful native plant garden. And I'm a plant person, not an entomologist, but every time I had my bug friends over, they'd be like, oh my goodness, there are so many bees here. You should really look at them. So we said, okay, well, we know about native plants, but we don't know much about native bees. And like you said, people usually think of, you know, the honeybee and the buzzing, you know, social dripping honey kind of a hive that honeybees have. But native bees are very different. They live a solitary life, most of them, although bumblebees are the exception to that. Mm-hmm. And they go in the ground and they lay their little egg. And they put some pollen down, and then the bees, you know, reemerge. They either live in underground or like in an old stick. And so nobody kind of knows that much about them. So we decided to actually hire somebody to study how do these native bees live, and what's their association with native plants.
Yeah, and that was consulting ecologist Matthew Sarver. Describe the different landscapes at the Mount Cuba Center, which were observed in the study.
Yeah, we did three sites, basically. We have over 1,000 acres of natural lands, but then we have these beautiful native plant gardens. So we did one on the floodplain, on the Red Clay Creek. We did one in a wet meadow on our natural lands. And then the third site was right in the garden proper.
Okay, and were there any surprises in what you found, species you weren't expecting?
Oh, we were just blown away, because in the state of Delaware, there's maybe about 200 species that were known of native bees. And when we've collected over 2 years, and we found over 3,500 bees and 135 different species. So that's like more than half of the bees known in Delaware, and 15 of those species had never been seen before in Delaware. And so kind of the take-home message is planted and they will come. These bees, some of bees are specialists and some are generalists. So the generalists just fly around and, you know, go on everything and they don't really care. But like I said, these native bees that put their little, you know, egg in the ground and out they come at a very specific time, synchronized with when that one plant, that special plant that they're associated with, is out. So these bees only live for a month or two, you know, the same time that the plants are in flower. And we found 23 species of pollen specialists. So in other words, they come out and they only live on that one plant. So we found a Jacob ladder minor bee that should have been in the Appalachians, but it's in Delaware. And we found a cellophane bee that lives on heuchera or coral bells.
Okay.
And that should have been in the Shenandoahs. So, you know, it's because these plants would probably occur in those areas, and because we have a lot of them, the bees somehow found their way to Mount Cuba, and they've never been seen in Delaware.
That's so interesting. And Eileen, so, you know, one of the big important findings was the greatest diversities of bee species were not found in Mount Cuba's, you know, natural hinterland.
But in the garden.
In the gardens. So how do you explain that?
Well, because, you know, unfortunately, with all the deer browse and the degradation of our forests, we don't have all the native species in the forest that we actually have at Mount Cuba in the garden. So the garden has a lot of diversity, and so we did find, you know, more diverse bees, you know, living on those different plants that aren't available in the forest.
So then, is the home garden more important than we might think to the survival of native bees if home gardeners plant native plants?
It's totally integral, you know, in this world when you're overwhelmed with all the negative news. The one thing you can really do is cultivate your garden, plant native plants, and you can really change the outcome for some of these little creatures.
Which plants are top attractions for native bees in say the Delaware Valley area?
Well,
you mentioned some before, but
yeah, I mean, they all are good, but things like Jacob's ladder or coral bells, you'll get that specialist bee that only grows on those particular plants. But things like rhododendrons and bluebells are great in the springtime. There's a little plant called the spring beauty that has its own little bee. But you want to make sure that you don't just don't do the spring, because there are native bees associated with summer and fall flowering choices as well. So goldenrods and asters and sunflowers and ironweed, those kinds of things. And then you want to throw in your woody plants as well. So willows are great for native bees, and as well as dogwoods. And the shrubby dogwoods, like the cornicimomum, is really great. And then things like brambles and hydrangeas. All of these native species attract, you know, different kinds of bees. So it's really an empowering thing that anybody can do. Plus, the gardens are beautiful. They're really pretty, and they're always changing. So, you know, if you have spring, summer, fall plants, there's always something to look at. As well as, if you're attracting bees, you're probably attracting butterflies and hummingbirds and just making your garden alive.
Yeah. You know the saying, you know, a weed is just a flower growing in the wrong place. Are many native plants considered to be weeds? And if so, how do we get past that word?
Well, I think when people are thinking about that, they're thinking about, you know, like maybe a meadow that looks a little unkept. You put the right plant in the right place, and it will grow beautifully. And if you come to Mount Cuba Center, we have these amazing formal gardens, you know, kind of in the style of English country gardens, that are full of native plants. And so if you use them in the right way, they're not weedy at all, and they're quite beautiful. And I think even more interesting, because they're constantly changing. And, you know, so it's really about a perception and just learning a little bit about the plants, because there's woodland plants, there's plants for the sun, you know, for the shade, for the wet, you know, there's always a good native plant that you can use.
Eileen, I was tooling around a number of articles on bees, you know, preparing for this segment, and one suggested that home gardeners consider increasing bees' natural habitat by letting part of the yard go wild, you know, maybe stop mowing, and so native flowering plant species. You know, it's probably a big ask, though, for many of us who might be concerned about what the neighbors would think. Is it time for a cultural shift here?
Oh, it totally is, and you have to bring your neighbors along with you, but you can't just suddenly, you know, let everything go wild and have a stick pile in the middle of your front lawn. So, you know, be cognizant about, you know, your native plant design, and my front yard is more formal, and, you know, the neighbors can look at it. My stick pile is in the corner in the back next to the compost where you kind of can't see it behind a fence. So, you know, but you don't have to kind of suddenly go wild. It just things like if you have perennials in your backyard and they're growing, don't cut them down as soon as they look untidy in the fall. Leave them up the whole year, because there's little native bees in there in the sticks. And then when you cut them down, put them in your compost pile or over to the side and let the bees emerge if they haven't already. And then if you see some bare soil, you know, where you think you have native bees, because you'll see little holes coming out in this time of year, just leave it alone. Don't put, you know, 12 inches of mulch on it. Just let it be. So I think we just have to show our neighbors the richness and the biodiversity of life that we can encourage, and they'll come along too. It's just... you know, sometimes we need a little explaining.
Well, another article offered this bit of advice about learning how to live with bees. You know, many of us are afraid of them. We don't want to be stung. And obviously, too, if you have an allergy, it's important to steer clear. But, you know, the article essentially says, when we stay calm in the presence of bees and don't get too close to any hives, it's easy to avoid being stung. They didn't talk about sticks or little holes in the ground, but I guess, you know, the sentiment is the same. You know, in your work at the Mount Cuba Center, Eileen, you know, it's 1,000 acres, I've read. Have you found this to be true? I mean, do you, if you're out there, have to maintain, I'm assuming you have to maintain a healthy relationship with bees?
Yes. And we, you know, don't use, we tried to only use pesticides as a last resort in a major collection. We are pretty much organic. And bees, I've never, in 18 years of, you know, being in the garden and in amongst the plants, I've never gotten stung. You know, bees are busy doing their thing. And, you know, especially the native bees, when they come out, you can walk amongst them and they don't ever sting you. They're, you know, maybe if you stepped on something.
Yeah.
But they really, you know, it's more honeybees that have the habit of stinging, and wasps. Mm.
Yeah.
But not so much the native bees.
Yeah. Well, don't run barefoot through the clover.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wait, and I will also say, I have at home, I've got a giant overgrown pink azalea that is a bee magnet.
Yes.
And I have found that when I stand at a respectful distance, it's really fun to watch them. I mean, they're just so busy and so purposeful, and it seems like all's well in the world, you know, when you're watching bees.
We actually have, in our trial garden, we trial these different plants, and we have a pollinator watch team, and their job is to go out and count bees and look at and see, like, you know, what are the favorite plants of the different bees. And it is kind of very zen. People love to do it.
Yeah. Just kind of getting off topic for a second, you know, climate change is one of the threats to bees. Eileen, have you noticed that climate change has altered or is altering the growing patterns at Mount Cuba Center?
You know, I've been teaching certain native plant classes, and the dates of it's been hard because you try to teach this class, and you're like, okay, this will be out the second week in April. And you know what? It's everything has moved up, I would say, about 2 weeks in the past 10 years. So there is a shift in the phenology. You do see it, you know, kind of get warmer earlier.
Well, one positive takeaway from the survey, again, is the suggestion that if enough home gardeners craft their gardens to appeal to native bee populations, the bees will arrive, and habitat loss can be mitigated. I mean, it's simple and huge at the same time.
Yes, and very empowering. And all you have to do is go to your garden center and buy some native plants. And I guarantee it, you'll have bees, birds, and butterflies before you know it.
Give us a plug for plants native to this area as we begin to wrap up the show, and why home gardeners might want to consider them at the top of the list when planting a garden.
In the springtime, any of your little spring ephemerals that come out and host you know, these bees, things like bellflowers or bearded tongues, like I said, goldenrods and asters, and any of your azaleas are great for bees, plus really, really beautiful. And any of the shrubby kind of things, clethra or, you know, you know, are any of our native rhododendrons are really great additions to the garden. And the thing is, they also get better and better every year. You know, you don't have to, when you plant perennials and woody plants, you're not out there planting petunias every year, because they come back and they're beautiful.
And again, if a gardener wants more information about matching a native plant to a specific bee, where can they go?
On our website, we have the Matt Sarver report, and it talks about specifically what plants you can plant for different bees, and, you know, just kind of what we found in the garden. And I just really want to encourage everybody to plant those native plants, because they're way more than pretty. You know, they really help our life.
They can make a difference, a real difference.
Yes.
Eileen Boyle, thank you so much for joining us. It's always nice to have encouraging news.
And we hope to see you all at Mount Cuba very soon.
All right, thanks. Eileen Boyle is Director of Conservation and Research at the Mount Cuba Center in Hocasin, Delaware. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.